Bane, reel three.
Now, you served throughout the war with territorial units. I was wondering whether it ever struck you that the character of the territorial units was at all different in any way from that of the regular
Oh
units.
yes, I was attached to one regular unit, the 2nd Sea Force, and their discipline was absolutely perfect. I mean, they were born soldiers. I put it down as the finest battalion of infantry I've ever seen in my life, the 2nd Sea Force Highlanders. But there, it was just a matter of very strict discipline. They had to do what they were told as they were told. There were no nonsense. Territorial, you had to work round them to their better nature, because the territorial had been accustomed looking after himself all his life at home and home life, and he liked to do things his own way, and very often his own way was a better way than the way that his officers told him to do it. And to be a certain amount of give and take to keep up the morale and make them realise. And of course, they were all just, they would do anything for each other, the territorials. A regular soldier just did exactly what he was told and nothing more. But a territorial, if he saw another fellow in trouble, he would go and give him a hand, even though it was in another platoon, another company. It didn't matter. He was a jock.
I would imagine that simply by virtue of being essentially civilians, territorials, by virtue of their background, would be less inclined to find acceptable the kind of slightly mindless discipline that the regular NCO might try to impose upon regular soldiers.
Yes, well, the territorials were independent, really. I mean, they could make up their own minds quickly, and they could adapt themselves to any circumstances. They would endure hardships that the regulars simply could not stand. I mean, when it came to muddy trenches, if you were up to the knees in mud, the territorials just say, "Oh, it's kind of wet the day, you see." Whereas the regular soldier would be complaining, wanting to get back to the reserve line to get dried out.
But wouldn't that probably be due more to the fact that your particular territories were coal miners and therefore had a great deal of experience of underground work and unpleasant conditions?
No, well, they weren't all coal miners. There were a great many farm labourers and engineers, workers, and apart from coal miners.
Can you think of any particular ways in which the way of doing things in the territorials were obviously different from the way of doing things in the regular units? Something specific you could pin down?
Well, no, I would only say that it was left more to the discretion of the territorials to do things than be told exactly what to do. If it came to an attack, for instance, the regular soldier expected to be told, "Well, you have to do that and that and that," but the territorial was simply said, "Well, you have to advance towards this line. Do it in your own way."
It sounds as if there was probably a rather more relaxed atmosphere in the territorial
Oh,
units.
there was indeed, yes. Oh, I mean, the discipline wasn't nearly so strict nor so good. I mean, I give the regular troops all credit for their wonderful discipline.
Would you ever consider, for example, addressing any of your men by their Christian names?
Occasionally, yes. My first experience of that was going into the line for the first time and walking along the trench at night. I was being guided round by an NCO, and I heard voices over the line, and the voices said, "Hey, do you ken who our new officer is?" So the other one said, "No, I didn't ken." He said, "Oh, it's young Bain from Alloa." And this one says, "Good God, to think I joined up to get away from his feather." So with that, I walked around to the trench and I said, Is that George Wright speaking? So this fellow says, I am George Wright. I said, I know you used to work at Dave and Pitt in Alloa. And I said, where's your pal, Jimmy Allen? He's here. I said, oh, the pair of you, well, I hope you work harder here than ever you worked when you were in the pits at Alloa, because I remember you're a pair of scrim shankers and pulled their leg. I mean, you had to do that.
Yeah.
After that, those fellows would have done anything.
Yes. Maybe this then was another common feature of many of the territorial units, that the people actually in them would very often know each other much better by virtue of having been brought up in the same area.
I had the names and addresses of all their wives and families. You see, and every time I came home on leave, I tried to visit as many as I could who were in the district. Really, the territorial, it was a great family concern. They were all, talk about brothers, but they were all just friendly, you see. The Falkirk motto was touch ain, touch all. Better middle with the deal than with the bairns of Falkirk. And we had a Falkirk company, and that was quite typical of them. They just stuck together like glue.
Yes. Okay. Now, towards the end of 1916, you had a period as assistant adjutant with the 7th Battalion of the Argyles.
Yes. Yeah.
What sort of work did you have to do in that capacity as assistant adjutant?
Do anything I was told.
But did you have particular areas of responsibility?
No.
Or you were sort of general?
Just throughout the whole battalion. Mm. Sometimes I had to look after the transport, the horses, make sure everything was all right there. Mm. We'd always about 30 or 40 horses for the horse-drawn transport. And when it came to parades, well, it was part of my job to see that everything was there on time. The adjutant would tell me, now, we're parading tomorrow at 9 o'clock, make sure that the troops are all out on parade by that time. And I had to make sure that orders got round, that everybody knew exactly what to do.
I see. And another thing which you did was this work, this intelligence work. What did that involve?
Well, attempting to keep a track of the any fresh enemy troops that came into the trenches, and there was a lot of aerial work going on at that. The Germans had complete supremacy in the air and were to watch for aeroplanes and that sort of thing and try and describe them. And then arranging sniping parties.
Mm. About this keeping track of what new German units were coming into the line, how did you do that? Where did you get your information from?
Principally through binoculars, or taking prisoners with patrols at night, going over the trenches, over the barbed wire to the German trenches, and picking up a few prisoners and discovering them. There were 60th Barbarian, whichever troops they had, Prussians or whoever they were, you see.
In practice, how much useful intelligence were you able to get out of these German prisoners?
Oh, a good deal. Well, whenever we captured one or two prisoners, that was supposed to be a very good thing, you see. Mm-hmm. Because the Bavarians were... They were quite simple people. They gave up their information. Of course, whenever we got prisoners, we had to send them back to divisional headquarters to be interviewed there. We personally, we never got very much out of them.
I see.
Because to begin with, there were none of us very proficient in German. Mm-hmm. We could say Handen auf and that sort of thing. And, or kommen Sie mit mir was the other thing, you see. And
The organising of sniping parties, which you've also mentioned, what was involved in that?
Well, arranging the positions which were out of sight of the enemy but had a commanding position on, say, a communication trench or any sniping positions that the enemy, we knew the enemy had. Mm-hmm. And being able to use those positions occasionally and dart about so that we didn't always go from the one spot.
Were there any particular problems which the sniping parties had to face?
Yes, it usually was rather difficult crawling in to get into position in daytime without being seen, and to remain still and unseen during the daytime.
Yeah, I think you told me last time that another of the problems was that the Germans had developed armour-plated loopholes.
Yes, they had armour-plated, little square armour-plated which you put up on their trenches, and unless you fired through this little half-inch hole, you could our bullets simply pinged off them, you see.
What did you do about that?
Well, I was home on leave, and I came across a friend who was with the Kynoch Cartridge Company, now taken over by ICI. And I was telling him about the trouble. He says, we're making armour-plated bullets that'll go through any armour plate. And I said, could you give me some? He said, well, I'll give you 20, but for God's sake, don't tell anybody I gave them to you. No, never be caught with them in your possession or you'll be shot, because they're supposed to be very lethal. Well, I got those, I think it was 20 or something, from this fellow, Ince, and went out. And of course, they were a great success. Whenever they fired at one of those armour-plated things, it just went right through and got the centre of the centre was behind, you see.
You didn't have any inhibitions about breaking regulations then? Eh?
No, none. No. I mean, it was, if we didn't get them, they got us.
Right. Now, how and when did you become involved in the mining operations?
It would be, I should think about the beginning of 1916. Yes. About the beginning of 19, we took over a section of trench, the labyrinth, from the French army, and they had commenced mining operations there. The Germans had blown up a lot of craters, and blown up a lot of the French lines with the mining operations, and the French were trying to counteract that by digging underground mines to counteract the Germans, and that was handed over to us sort of piecemeal, without there wasn't a map even of the trenches. That was one of my first jobs, was to prepare a map of the trenches of the labyrinth, showing where all the outs and ins were, and also those mines, which I did with the aid of an ordinary field compass and very often just stepping out. It was rough and ready, but it did the job. Then when we took over this line and saw those holes in the ground, somebody said, oh, but those are mines that have been going to try and blow up the Germans. So I was asked, being a bit of a mining engineer, could I tackle it? And some of my miners, you see, so we took over one or two of them and started digging, and they were small, just like rabbit holes, about 2 feet across by about 2 feet square, and we'd just to dig in through the sand and prop up the sides with wooden boards to keep them from falling in. And it was all right. If we could hear the Germans working in their mines, we were quite safe. But whenever they stopped working, there was always a danger that they were going to prepare to blow up a mine, you see. However, that never happened to us while I was there.
When you took over this mining operation, and started continuing the tunnelling that the French had begun, what was your objective? What were you aiming at?
To get in under the German lines sufficiently so that we could put in a charge of powder there to blow it up. The explosive, it was high explosive that was used, Amitol, but the whole idea was to get in under, completely under their lines and blow it up. Our frontline trenches at that time were only about 20 yards apart, and they were very close, and the mine entrance had to be considerable distance back, because all the stuff that was taken out had to be hauled out in sandbags and taken away and dumped so that it wouldn't show up to the Germans what we were doing.